Hello and welcome to Databook. I am Jack Murtha.
And I am Tom Castles. Thanks again for joining us on Databook. If you're a fan of this podcast, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and review.
Just a reminder, this is a healthcare analytics news podcast, and you can check us out online at hcanews.com. We are also on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And I want to give props to NBC4 New York for the great reporting that helped inform today's story.
Yeah, thank you kindly, NBC. Now, today we have another fantastic guest. His name is Dr. David Albert. Dave Albert is a physician, he's an entrepreneur, a scientist, he's also a prolific inventor. And he's also the founder and CMO of AliveCore. It's a leading digital health company in the cardiovascular care space. Today we brought him on to talk a little bit more about wearables, the evolving landscape, and how they're impacting healthcare today.
But before we get to that, let's head to the Bronx in New York City.
We're going to a bowling alley today. It's in a working class neighborhood, the drinks are cheap, and so is access to the lanes.
So this place is called Bowlerland. There's the rumbling of tumbling pins, the 1980s-ish neon carpeting complete with weird shapes, the glow of fluorescent overhead lighting. You can almost hear the cheers of the Thursday night bowling leagues.
So Bowlerland feels a lot like your typical Main Street America bowling alley. I'm sure you know the one I'm talking about. It's like a piece of the past, a relic that has withstood the storms of tech progress.
But here's the thing. While Bowlerland might be seeping with nostalgia, it harbors a very high-tech story, a story that will probably become a lot more common in the years ahead.
It's the story of how a sleek little piece of tech helped save a life.
It's early spring of this year, and William Monzadelis is walking around wearing his third Apple Watch.
Yeah, that was not a mistake. It's his third Apple Watch. No one's accusing this guy of being a Luddite.
The thing is, it won't be until today, April 3rd, that he fully understands just how powerful his Apple Watch is.
William is working at his family business. It's Bowlerland, that bowling alley we just described to you, and it's a pretty normal day. But then all of a sudden, William starts to feel dizzy.
So he heads to the bathroom, hoping to get himself in order.
But instead of getting himself in order, he starts bleeding.
Now, William is 32 years old, he's pretty healthy, and there's really not much reason to think that something is seriously wrong with him medically.
But soon enough, his Apple Watch chimes in. The device displays a message urging William to seek medical attention immediately.
The smartwatch says his heart rate is all over the place. This is real, and it's time to get to the hospital.
So his mom is also working at the bowling alley. She sees how bad her son looks, and she immediately just tosses him right into the car.
So what happens next is even more intense. He starts having seizures. And he's bleeding everywhere.
Blood's coming out of his mouth and other very unfortunate places. William is dipping in and out of consciousness.
It takes them a half hour to get to the hospital, and by then, he's lost almost 80% of his blood.
That's 80%. Just imagine that. He's in such bad shape that he needs a blood transfusion before he can even get anesthesia for his surgery.
And what kind of surgery are we talking about? Well, clinicians at the hospital determine that this terrible ordeal is all because of an erupted ulcer.
But there is some good news. The surgery ends up going really well. Perfectly, really.
Today, William says he feels like $1 million.
But this story could have had a much more devastating ending.
If not for the warning from his Apple Watch, William says he probably would have went back to work. He says his family probably would have found him dead in his office.
But the thing is, he did get that critical notification from his watch. Even his doctors credit the Apple Watch for making him pay attention to his symptoms.
For pushing him to take action.
For ultimately helping to save his life.
William Monzadelis' story is not one of a kind. Wearables have saved other people, too.
There was a Fitbit that led doctors to finding two blood clots in a woman's lungs.
A smartwatch that helped an 18-year-old learn that her kidneys were failing.
And another Apple Watch. This one was nudging a man to receive treatment for what he found out later was a heart attack.
Look, the list goes on and on and on. And yeah, most of these stories tend to deal with a user's heart rate. But we're still sort of in the early days of wearables and mHealth. Who knows what else they'll be capable of doing in the not-too-distant future.
We can tell you that right now, all new Apple Watches will feature EKG readers. They also have fall detection systems.
I can see that being especially helpful for older folks.
The point is that wearables, both the hardware and the software, they're proving to be valuable medical tools. So to tell us more about that, we brought on Dr. David Albert. And let me just remind you who Dave Albert is once again. He's a physician, an entrepreneur, a scientist, and a prolific inventor. He's the founder and CMO of AliveCore. It's a leading digital health company in the cardiovascular care space. Dave has 60 issued U.S. patents and around 100 publications and presentations in the cardiology literature. He went to Harvard as an undergrad and then to Duke Medical School and Biomedical Engineering Graduate School at Duke as well. Then he came back to the University of Oklahoma, where he currently lives, and AliveCore is the fourth company that he started. It's one that's driven completely by Albert's inventions and ingenuity. So, Dr. Albert, thanks so much for joining us on Databook today.
Sure.
So, everybody, we have a really cool opportunity right now to get inside the mind of a prolific modern-day inventor. Dr. Dave, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about what you've been up to lately and what you're doing in the wearable space?
Sounds good to me. AliveCore has been around, started the company in 2011. Today, we have around 50 employees. We've sold hundreds of thousands of personal EKG devices. Most recently, we felt like we were lone rangers in this market. And a couple of weeks ago, we were joined by a small company, maybe from called Apple. Apple Watch Series 4 with built-in EKG capability, a function that we had been working on for quite a while. So we feel like we're not alone anymore. My late father would have said he was a Rhodes Scholar, but from rural Oklahoma, we are living in tall cotton, you know, having our principal competitor be the world's most profitable and most valuable company. So I feel very honored and flattered that they think the ideas I came up with seem to be ones worth copying. And as Steve Jobs says, good ideas are worth copying, great ideas are worth stealing. We've been involved in the wearable space almost from the beginning, and you know, have watched the evolution of companies like Fitbit and Garmin, and then the introduction of giant companies like Samsung and Apple, and seen the evolution. And I think, you know, we're quite frankly, we're still in the early innings of the development of wearables in society.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you for that, Doctor. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about your strategies. I know inventing is a huge part of what you do. I was looking at your profile today on Twitter and something really stood out to me.
Saving lives one invention at a time.
Right, that's it. So that's the personal mantra that drives you, and I just love it. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Well, I'm blessed. We have fulfilled lives if we get to do something we love as a job and make money and support our families. And I get to do that. And, you know, not only do I get the wonderful feedback of being creative and inventive, but those inventions have principally been focused on helping people. And so that's really rewarding to me. It's humbling to think that, you know, something so simple as thinking I could take a smartphone and turn it into a personal EKG device, an idea, by the way, I had in 1995, long before there were smartphones, which is why it didn't happen until 2011. But that device is able to put information in people's hands that allow them, either as patients or as physicians and nurses, to bring appropriate therapy, the right therapy, to the right person at the right time.
So what drives your thinking in this area? Are you actively searching for ways to innovate at all times? Are you constantly measuring the world and looking for entry points for improvement? Or have you just kind of reframed the everyday efficiencies that drive the rest of us crazy into the inspiration that drives your inventive thinking? How does that work?
What helps me is that I have what I call orthogonal thinking. Now, what that means is, you know, in geometry terms, orthogonal means you're at 90 degrees, you're at a right angle to something. Well, you know, if you have conventional wisdom, how people do whatever it is every day and have done it, and you look along that stream of how they think, along that conventional wisdom, very difficult for you to innovate. You are bound by conventional wisdom. However, if you come at it from 90 degrees, that is, you are perpendicular to that conventional thinking, then you're able to have a different perspective and to see how solutions might be created that are new and innovative and that solve problems that exist. I don't focus on energy, or I don't focus on biotechnology. I focus principally on cardiovascular evaluation and therapy. And so I look at what's being done today, and I try to basically take a completely different perspective. I say that there's a better way, a priori, there's a better way than what people do today. Now, that's not always true. There's an old saying in surgery that if at least 50% of the appendices you operate on are not infected, you're not doing enough operations. That is, you, in order to catch all of them, you're going to operate on some people that didn't have an appendicitis. And I feel that way about inventing. I'm going to throw a lot of ideas up against the wall, and only a few of them are going to stick. And of those, only a very few of them will turn out to be true innovations that make a difference. And so I try to be open-minded. You know, people talk about open innovation. I look for ideas and inspiration all over. And I find special inspiration from what I call old ideas. You know, people have been smart for a long, long time. You go back to Da Vinci and his ilk. You know, people have been incredibly creative, incredibly talented, and incredibly brilliant. And, you know, the old saying is we stand on the shoulders of giants. That's certainly true in cardiovascular medicine. So I look back at ideas that people had in the 20th century, and I mean, don't just mean the 1990s, but the 1980s, 70s, 60s, 50s, when technology began to be used, really post-World War II. You know, technology came into its own, the development of the transistor and then the integrated circuit, development of really x-rays and then ultrasonic imaging and things of that nature, a lot of which grew out of the Defense Department or the space program. And I look at those things and say, how can today's technology, machine learning, AI, very high-powered yet low-power consumption electronics, how can those things take an old idea and make it new again? And I've got a couple of those that have that are promising innovations that are basically new implementations using modern technology of old ideas. And so that's one, what I would call rich vein of ideas that I mine, as well as, you know, the notion of looking at a problem and trying to figure out how to solve it. I can tell you one thing though. There are some people who invent. This is not a dig at engineers. I work with them every day and they implement things that I could not, that ideas I have that I could never implement. However, when they are themselves innovating in many instances, and I have lots of examples, they'll invent a technology, something new, and then they'll go try to find a problem for it to solve. And that is putting the cart in front of the horse. That seldom works. So what you want to do is you want to see a problem and then go try to find a solution. And so that's another method I use to develop innovations.
So now we have a much better idea of the thinking that has driven you to the founding of AliveCor, these EKG sensors that, as you said, Apple is doing its best to copy. So I'd love for you to take a nice hack at this next one. It seems like there are new announcements regarding this wearable foray into healthcare pretty much every day. What do you really make of all this? What would you say are the implications of this new tech entering the healthcare space?
The reality is that it's pile on. This market and this opportunity has now been validated as much as you can validate something by the entry of Apple. And I can tell you, the largest companies in the world are shocked at what Apple did and how deep they went into the regulated part of healthcare as opposed to the fitness. And I think what you'll see is all of them clamoring to try to catch up in an area that, by the way, we were in a long time ago. Companies often try to catch up quickly using other than innovative means, let me put it that way. And so it's interesting. Let's just say we've had a lot of phone calls and emails since Apple made their introduction of their Apple Watch Series 4, and it's appropriate. It's real. You know, one thing I can say, which way are copays and deductibles going for, you know, your average insured American? They're only going in one direction. They've only been going in one direction. They're going up. You know, I don't hear anybody saying, gosh, my health insurance costs 15% less than it did last year. No, you hear them say it costs 10% more. So the notion that people are going to be more financially responsible, individuals are, means that they're going to want to be more engaged. They're going to have to become smarter shoppers. What you see is people understanding at the same time science saying, oh, by the way, whether it's heart disease or diabetes, emphysema, these are diseases that are due to lifestyle. And so people are understanding that. Not that it's easy to change your lifestyle, it's not. But they're looking for tools, things that allow them to understand how they're doing. They look for coaching. So the sustained intervention into your own lifestyle is going to be a major challenge. And people are looking to technology, to these globally connected supercomputers that we all have in our pocket. And so that will become the gateway. That will become the access point to both lifestyle coaching, guidance, as well as healthcare.
What is the biggest advantage of wearable tech? And what would you say is the most important misconception surrounding wearable tech? And how do we overcome that?
Well, first of all, if it's wearable, it probably needs to be invisible. Okay, Google Glass became controversial because everyone thought you were video or filming or recording me when I looked at you with your funky glasses. It wasn't invisible. If you're wearing a Fitbit today, or an Apple Watch, or any other type of a fitness health tracking device, people know that. But they don't know whether or not you pay any attention to it. Whenever you wear something, it becomes a piece of fashion. And so I've heard people talk about, you know, instrumented underwear, special socks, special shoes, special hats, special brassieres, special everything, instrumented everything. And the reality is that when you wear something, it better be cool. I don't care if you're 70 or if you're 20, it needs to be cool. It needs to fit with your fashion. So it needs to be invisible. Two, it needs to produce data that actually means something to you, the wearer, okay? Is it helping me, reminding me that I need to get up and move because I've been sitting at this desk for too long? Is it telling me how many calories I've burned? And so, you know, it's doing something that is really useful. And there are great examples in medicine. Today, we have companies that are making continuous glucose monitors. Okay, whether it's the Abbott Libre on your arm or Dexcom's devices or Medtronic's devices. And those are being partnered with insulin pumps, creating closed loop glucose management for diabetes. That's revolutionary. That means I don't have to worry about what I eat potentially. I don't have to worry about pricking my finger. I don't have to worry about going and giving myself a shot of insulin after I just had this, you know, this lunch with too many carbs. It's all going to be done behind the scenes, automatically, and it's going to be done well. It's going to keep me safer than it was before because it's continuous, it's ever vigilant. And by the way, it doesn't get sleepy, doesn't get tired. It works all the time. And so that delivers tremendous value. We're going to find other applications, like potentially monitoring of blood pressure. We don't have a continuous blood pressure monitor yet, but I can tell you another corporate partner of AliveCor and an investor, Omron, which makes probably and sells more blood pressure cuffs than any company in the world, they're going to be coming out with a true wristwatch blood pressure monitor here in the, you know, the last part of 2018. And that will be revolutionary. You'll be able to walk around and take a blood pressure measurement anywhere. There are 85 million Americans who are diagnosed with hypertension or high blood pressure. And many of them could deal with that without taking medication if they changed their diet and their activity pattern. But they don't, because we're a fast food, instant gratification society. So give me a pill, doc, and that way I can continue to put salt on my food and continue to be a couch potato. Well, the reality is these things you can see can work together. If it tells you to get up and move and it tracks your calories and it tracks your weight and it tracks your blood pressure, well, then it can help you manage your life and your health. And again, as I said in the beginning, much of disease, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, are lifestyle related. And so if we can improve our lifestyle using wearable technology through its monitoring, through its coaching, then we can prevent the huge burden that chronic disease brings on our society and on individuals. And so I see wearable technology, again, we're in the early innings, but I see it evolving along the model of the continuous glucose monitor, continuous insulin pump, continuous blood pressure monitor, continuous heart monitor, and enabling us to not just deal with disease, but to prevent disease.
To that end, do you think that wearable tech will or should achieve enterprise-level adoption in health systems?
Well, it already is. So what you heard this past week is, I forget which insurance company, said that they're only going to write policies for real-time risk management, which means if you want an insurance, a life insurance policy from them, you got to wear a fitness tracker and you got to get on a scale. They're going to monitor you and they're going to incentivize you and give you bonuses. I mean, human beings respond to gamification, to competition, to rewards. And so you're going to see more and more of that happening around the world. The people who bear the risk, it's not just you, but it's the people, it's your employer. It's the people who write your insurance policies, be that a health insurance or life insurance, are going to take advantage of the fact that they can both monitor and incentivize you for healthy living. And so I think that's already happening. And as we see positive results coming from those efforts, it will become normal practice. A single point physical for a life insurance policy is based on what I'd call old think. That's the old notion of you have actuaries looking at life tables in actual books. Remember what a book is? It's a very strange thing. Today we have real time, big data and AI and predictive analytics. And so your risk might be different next week than it is today or next year. And so what you need to pay and what that insurance company wants you to pay in order to, by the way, cover your risk and make a profit could be different. And so I'll see, just like there is in the electricity generation business, there's something called real-time pricing. So that at your meter, the price you're paying per kilowatt hour can change depending on the demand. Well, depending on your risk, your insurance may change, and certainly your employer is interested in that because in the United States, they're the largest provider of health insurance. With reality being that as we get older, no matter what you do, and I spend a lot of time taking care of my health, you still get older. Immortality is not in our grasp, let me put it that way. So, you have to adjust these things, but reality is your chronologic age and your physiologic or health age are two different things. And wearables will allow enterprises, your employer, your insurer, to help motivate you financially and other ways to live better, live a healthier lifestyle.
Now, you said that you and your son and your wife, who are currently practicing physicians, they don't always want this sort of deluge of data from wearable tech. Can you explain why that is? What's driving that reticence? And what can executives do to persuade clinicians that this data is actually worth capturing?
Well, I think they're all working on it. I mean, I can tell you early in, and give you an anecdote from AliveCor. Early in our, probably 2012, I had a meeting with the chief of cardiology at the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center, Dr. Jeff Olgan, a brilliant physician. And he told me, Dave, I gave one of your devices to one of my patients. And the first day he sent me 20 EKGs. Oh my God. And I'm liable if I miss one and it happens to be life-threatening, you got to help me here. What we need is we need that data. I need to know, are you getting better than you were last time? Are you getting worse? Have you gained weight? Have you lost weight? Is your blood pressure still under control? Do we need to change your medicines? Is your heart rate staying in the range we want it to, or do I need to modify something about your therapeutic regimen? That's what I mean. And the only way to distill thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of data points is using AI. And I think people like Fitbit understand that. People like AliveCor definitely understand that. And people like Epic. I mean, we all understand that we don't want to bury physicians. They are under enough pressure. You see your physician, let's just say you see your physician twice a year. Yeah, for 15 minutes. That is, you have 30 minutes of FaceTime per year with your physician. We need to help doctors be more efficient, to be able to see more patients, take better care of them. And I believe wearables will be instrumental in that process, but only when the information they generate, the data they generate, can be turned using artificial intelligence, using neural networks and deep learning into actionable insights for a physician.
Now, finally, let's take that one step further. What's in it for hospital execs and health systems? Why should they be keeping an eye on these products and trying to implement them into their continuum of care?
Well, first of all, hospitals don't make any money unless you're in the hospital. So keeping people out of the hospital is a scary proposition. Empty beds are scary propositions to hospital administrators. I have three words for them. Get over it. They're scared of telehealth. They're scared of remote monitoring. They're scared of concepts like the medical home, just like they were frightened in the beginning of standalone surgery centers until they co-opted them and bought them and integrated them. And they were scared of standalone birthing centers and specialty hospitals. Digital health in general is frightening, but if you look at hospitals, they're all piloting digital health. If you look at major medical centers, many of them have started their own incubators, their own accelerators, their own venture capital funds. They're all doing it because the last thing they can afford to be is left behind. So what I think you'll see is people being intelligent about their capital expenditures. Should we build that new wing? Should we build that new hospital in the suburbs as they see what happens? You know, are we going to be able to treat more people quicker on an outpatient basis? Will we have heart attacks treated in the emergency room? A stent placed and a guy sent home, you know, a few hours later, not even admitted to the CCU, with a remote monitor and a vest that can defibrillate them if they have an arrhythmia. That's not science fiction. That's reality. And so that bed in the corner of care unit never gets filled. That kind of thing is what everybody's looking at. And the hospital administrators, at least the smart ones, are trying to figure out how it's going to impact their census, their revenue, and how they can get involved with it. So I think you'll see healthcare organizations, the large ones, the Intermountains, the Kaisers, embracing telehealth and looking to see if they can find more patients who might need to be in one of those beds of theirs, at least for a certain amount of time. And then there's one other aspect to it. When Medicare instituted the readmission penalties a few years ago, that was the first time ever in the United States that when the nurse rolled the patient in the wheelchair out to the car, that the hospital gave a damn about what happened to them. Because it used to be, oh, so they got readmitted. They're back in heart failure a week later. Well, cha-ching, there goes the cash register again. But all of a sudden, payers have said, wait a second, you didn't do a good enough job. Over in Europe, those people don't have the readmission rates and nor the mortality that we have. And, you know, it's becoming obvious that in the United States, we spend a lot more than anybody else, but we don't necessarily get the outcomes. And so all of a sudden, those hospitals, because the last thing they want is to have somebody in their intensive care unit and they're footing the bill. So they'd much rather that they take better care of them, you know, rather that that person spend one more day in the hospital before they're discharged and that they are able to monitor and to potentially prevent remotely a problem that would cause a readmission. And so finally you have hospital administrators understanding that it is in their best interest to worry about the patient when they leave their facility. And so that began a process that's going to continue. It doesn't matter what readmission penalties happen. That's going to continue. And readmission penalties were probably a fairly blunt force object, but they at least got those administrators to think, I need to be aware of what's going on with that patient. Well, that means remote monitoring. That means wearables.
So it feels to me like we've run the full wearables gamut here, Dr. Albert, but what else would you like to add?
Well, I think it's interesting that the people getting into wearables and getting into healthcare wearables, not just fitness wearables, are the large consumer electronic companies, the Apples, the Googles, the Samsungs, and not the GEs, Philips, Medtronics. And so I think you'll see a convergence. The Medtronics and the Philips and the GEs and the Abbotts are understanding that they, the J&Js, that they need to be engaged in digital health. And all of them have efforts and are trying to make sure that they, like the hospital administrators, don't wake up one morning and find one of their businesses taken away by an Apple or by a Google. And so they're diligently at work evaluating these technologies and how they may fit into their business models.
Dr. Dave Albert, everyone, the founder of AliveCore, prolific inventor, and good friend of the DataBook podcast, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, sir.
All right, another great conversation on DataBook. Before we let you go, we just want to remind you that if you could rate, subscribe, and review this podcast, if you like it, it would be a big help.
Yeah, it would really mean the world to us. And we would also love it if you could visit our website, Healthcare Analytics News, and reach out to us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn.
Remember, hcanews.com. And for this episode of DataBook, I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles.